crude oil and commodities rebounded from the lows while equities investors locked in some profits. Well, happy Independence Day to our U.S. listeners. It's just great to be back with you on this long 4th of July holiday weekend with another mega-sized GoldSeek.com episode. Okay, by now most of my listeners and readers are wondering, what's going on with Chris and cryptocurrencies? Yes, I've caught not only gold and silver fever, but my latest malady, cryptocurrencies, and the only panacea, ICOs, initial currency offerings. You know, every passing day, I'm really becoming more convinced that the blockchain revolution is going to change the world in ways that I think few people could even imagine back in 1992 with the World Wide Web. You know, what's really exciting is that with just $10, $100, or less, anybody with a computer can participate in most ICOs, some of which have skyrocketed 10, 100, and thousands of fold. At play here is decentralization. It's one of the key advances of the blockchain technology revolution. So what does this really mean in the real world? I mean, is this plausible, or is it just another Ask Jeeves, you know, tulip mania? Imagine if you cut out your banking middleman. No more big hefty fees, with still totally safe and virtually unregulated, and perhaps even anonymous in many cases, such as with Komodo and others. This is a huge opportunity for a banking ICO, and I'll be highlighting it, big banking ICO, in this weekend's Alpha Stocks cryptocurrency newsletter. You can also decentralize insurance. Just think of the savings to people cutting premiums in half, maybe even in half again, and still offering dividends to investors. We've got an insurance ICO coming up. I even have dividends with the hottest rated ICO I have seen in months on the docket in a week or two, has a 25% dividend, and hold on to your hat. It invests in 10 or 20 of the hottest high-tech, out-of-the-box thinking startups. I think this is a grand slam, and I'm giving it my highest mega hot rating on the Alpha Stocks newsletter, and it'll also have the PDF there so you can read their white paper, as they call it. So let's move on now to this idea of non-centralized processing. Cryptocurrencies like Ethereum, they're not just currencies, they're also platforms that allow you to issue contracts. In fact, that's exactly the concept behind my BitSilver, my two current, my Crypto Gold and Crypto Silver. If you're interested, the Crypto Gold has 1 gram per 100 tokens backing. You might think of it as a covered call, if you will, on gold. And the Crypto Silver has 1 gram of silver for every 2 tokens. But I think there's applications just beyond what most people have even begun to think. For instance, you may have heard that IBM and Samsung came together in a partnership. They used Ethereum to help one of their smart washing machines call in an order to be repaired and pay for the order when it needed repairs and then order more detergent. We're sort of, you know, removing the wheat from the chaff. I tell you which ones I'm participating in and what looks best. As for the creating your own cryptocurrency, I really don't buy the Ponzi scheme theory here. Some of my guests who are not interested in cryptocurrencies, I think, are missing maybe a big picture here. These tokens that we're issuing are backed by gold and silver. There's nothing Ponzi about that. If the currency could be diluted, sure, that would be a Ponzi scheme, but there's a fixed number. The gold and silver are already in the vault. There's scarcity, and when scarcity is combined with the usefulness of Ethereum, you know, that creates demand. And as we all know, demand creates value. And frankly, we've already finished our Silver Bit token sale. It's sold out. It's closed. And we've added, as I mentioned, Crypto Gold rewards and the Crypto Silver rewards. The one that I'm really interested in, though, is Crypto Hedge Fund. My idea for a hedge fund, which already has big capital moving behind it, is to essentially buy up as many ICOs that are on the hot list as possible and then locked in funds for 2 years. And at the end of 2 years, all of the ICOs are liquidated at the current market price. The problem is it involves fiduciary responsibility, which means basically acting with other people's money. That requires an LLC, limited partnership. So we're working on that. But if you're interested, you know, I've already had big numbers already sent over that I've had to return. And if you'd like to invest in either of our current tokens, of course, we accept Bitcoin and Ethereum as well. You can just send it right over there and I'll update your account. And just in case you're concerned, at any time after the ICO, if you'd like delivery of your gold or silver tokens or coins, cover those expenses to your address. Okay, so joining me in the discussion, Peter Schiff of Schiff Gold, Euro-Pacific Capital. Despite the efforts of the powers to be, gold has still returned about 10% this year and inevitably will rise to its 2000 target. He's still calling for rate cuts and renewed QE. They were talking, what, 3 or 4 rate cuts a year? We've only seen one per year, and I'm not expecting another this year. Maybe in December, but likely in 2018. Plus, he agrees with Robert Shiller. Home ownership is near 60-year lows, except housing prices are at bubble 2.0 levels. And then part one of a big discussion with Martin Armstrong from Armstrong Economics. He discusses his upcoming seminars, one in Florida and another in Europe. He also talks about a screenplay for his Hollywood film they're preparing for. He's calling for Dow 23,000, and if we cross that level, you could see a parabolic move. And he thinks gold and silver could follow equities higher when they start to go parabolic. And Goldseek has a new sponsor. It's Silvercorp, a mid-tier producer, ticker SVM. And I guess I got lucky. I called the bottom last week, and it rocketed higher this week. For full transparency, several folks at Goldseek are interested in purchasing shares. And remember, we'd like to have you as part of the Alpha Stocks newsletter. You get participation in the ICOs, and we have all the latest ICOs and stock candidates, as well as market updates and market trends followed for you in real time. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report. Goldseek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Well, mostly sunny skies hovered over the precious metals sector on news that the dollar plunged to new lows. According to the Chicago Business Barometer, the PMI, in June, we saw numbers well above the expected reading, showing very solid growth. And consumer sentiment was considerably higher than the Wall Street expectations. Gold was off just $14, ending at $1,242, while silver finished near break-even at $1,663 an ounce. The precious metals XAU shares were off just 265, about 3%, ending at 83.50, while black gold reversed a 5-week sell-off, adding $2 this week, up almost 5%, finishing at 45 per barrel. That on news that the U.S. oil rig count dropped for the first time in about 6 months. On news of U.S.-Mexico petroleum pipeline. The top story impacting the metals this week. One of the Fed's closely watched inflation figures, the core index that excludes food and energy. Who needs food and energy, right? Was up a bit in May. The Fed is targeting, of course, 2% annual inflation, and it's been relatively low lately. Plus, the Chicago Purchasing Managers Index, as I mentioned, was the strongest in about 3 years. Although it seems like that would leave the Fed plenty of wiggle room for rate hikes, the current Fed funds futures indicate rather low odds of another rate hike this year. Solid odds of one more hike in spring of 2018 looks more likely. Precious metals bottom line. Well, lots of positive technical support in the CRB in West Texas. That's certainly a positive for the commodities sector. Plus, we saw the biggest spike in wheat prices in 7 years on a Dakota drought. Plus, the greenback was virtually in a free fall. Silver rebounded sharply from lows over the last 2 weeks. I'd like to see gold and the XAU shares, though, start to participate in the strength. You know, Spain's recent failed Banco Popular, $195 billion in assets, was purchased by Banco Santander for a price of just 1 euro. I mean, this is reminiscent of the Bear Stearns bailout of J.P. Morgan in 2008. I really feel like our policymakers have learned their lesson that we have to take these bank bailouts much more seriously and much more quickly. But could we be setting ourselves up for even more serious catastrophe by bailing out all these institutions sort of quietly and under the table? I mean, even Robert Shiller of the Case-Shiller Index fame says he hasn't seen housing prices like this since 1929 and the year 2000. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly sunny skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange after 5 solid winning weeks. Traders took some profits. Still, the main benchmarks posted solid quarterly gains. The S&P 500 and the NASDAQ finished the first half of the year with the best advances in several years. Next week, equity trading will be shortened by the Independence Day holiday on Tuesday. The weaker dollar did hurt blue chips a bit as they lost their relative advantage in the global markets. The Dow Jones found support at 21,349, off fractionally at about 45 points. The index is still up in monthly and quarterly gains of around 1.6 and 3.3%, while the S&P 500 fell this week only 15 points down to 2423. And the NASDAQ was hardest hit, dropping 2%, 124 points, ending at 6140. Still, the NASDAQ is up about 4% this quarter, 14% since the beginning of the year, and it's the best half-year performance in about a decade. Lastly, the Bitcoin ETF, GBTC, was off just 11%. That may sound like a lot, but for this volatile index, that's hardly even a day's movement. Off 48 points, finishing just shy of 400, while the Komodo coin gave back about 15%, KMD, around $1.77. Meanwhile, on Friday, the Dow Jones Industrials added 62 points on thanks in no small part to a big rally in Nike shares, which gained 11%, the best one-day percentage rally in years on Thursday after posting better-than-expected quarterly profits and sales. Nike also confirmed a deal to sell shoes through Amazon. AMZN, one of our favorite alpha stock candidates. Plus, shares of home builders attracted buyers, which pushed up D.R. Horton, DHI, the ticker there, about 2.5%, and PulteGroup, PHM, the ticker. Plus, Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway said it would exercise warrants to buy 700 million shares of Bank of America's common stock, thanks to a new solid dividend. Bottom line on equities. Well, the technical outlook remains solid here. Our 7-indicator greed to fear index is still in nearly perfect neutral territory under 50. You know, if this were a peak, we would expect frothy readings, you know, 70, 80, 90. We just don't see much signs of frothiness. I see mostly typical profit taking and sectional rotation. I expect this consolidation to shake out the weak hands before the next run to higher levels. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio. We'd like for you to stay with us. Thanks for choosing GoldSeek.com as a trusted business and financial news source. Today's special guest, Peter Schiff from SchiffGold.com.
Okay, Peter Schiff, chairman of Schiff Gold, located at SchiffGold.com, author of several bestsellers. Welcome back, Peter Schiff.
Well, thanks for a welcome back.
It's great to have you. And, you know, wanted to ask you about this U.S. equity rally. You know, we've seen this market reach some pretty frothy levels. That's on the one hand. But on the other, you know, we're not seeing too many signs of, you know, overly bullish sentiment, at least in our 7 indicator here that we watch closely at USA Today. Do you have any thoughts on the sector? And
well, I don't know. I see a lot of bullishness out there because pretty much the markets think that they can't lose, right? They think that either Trump is going to revitalize the economy with massive government spending, stimulus, tax cuts, deregulation, and that's going to drive profits, and that's going to be good for the stock market. Or they think that these things are not going to happen. The economy is going to weaken, and then the Fed is going to come to its rescue with another round of rate cuts and quantitative easing. So either way, you can make a bullish argument for the stock market, or people are making a bullish argument, and so people continue to buy stocks. But, you know, one of the things I've been pointing out is that year to date, it's the foreign stock markets that are up much more than the U.S. stock markets, and the best performers are the emerging markets. So if you buy into the idea that stocks are going to go up, at least so far this year, it's foreign stocks that are going up a lot more than domestic stocks. And of course, that's being helped by the fact that today the dollar is at a 7-month low. It's almost at a 1-year low against the euro. So a lot of that optimism is already fading.
Okay, but let's talk about that U.S. dollar. We typically see the precious metals rally along with a weaker dollar, the weaker greenback. We're not getting that this time. To what do you attribute that?
Well, you know, gold is up, what, about 10-11% this year, so it has rallied, but, you know, why hasn't it rallied more? Well, I think it will. I mean, we did get a big sell order coming into the market 4 a.m. on Monday that knocked gold down about $15. I mean, every time it's about to break out, somebody comes in and sells a tremendous amount of it all at one time. So obviously there are some, you know, headwinds there. There are some people trying to keep the price of gold from rising for whatever reason, but they will not be successful long term. The gold price is going to go up as the dollar weakens. It is going to go up in particular as the Fed has to acknowledge the underlying weakness in the economy that they've been denying. You know, they're data dependent, yet they've raised interest rates now three times since Trump was elected, despite the fact that the data is getting worse. You know, the U.S. economy is much weaker today when the Fed is raising rates than it was under Obama when the Fed chose not to raise rates. I mean, they only raised rates really one time during the Obama presidency. He was there for two terms, and they waited till after Trump was elected to raise rates again. I think when the Fed has to admit how weak things are, that is going to really accelerate the move up in gold.
I'll contend that the Fed policymakers are drunk on their own Kool-Aid. They apparently, you know, believe these fake numbers. They believe that unemployment is at the lowest level in 30 years, whereas in reality, we have the worst underemployment, I think, in decades.
Yeah, and you know, it's all depending on your perspective. Remember when Donald Trump was a candidate, he said the unemployment numbers were fake too. Now that he's a president, he's embraced them as proof that he's doing a good job.
So tell us a bit, though, about this breakdown on the CRB. Last week, we warned subscribers and listeners that the CRB was in a free fall. Not a really positive sign when you have such a weak dollar.
A lot of it is crude oil driven, and oil may have found a bottom, we'll see. But a lot of it is also due to the incredible weakness in the U.S. economy. I mean, the U.S. economy is a major consumer of commodities, raw materials, and the fact that consumption is so weak in the U.S., is a short-term problem. Now, obviously, when the dollar falls sufficiently, then that will really invigorate international demand for commodities, because as the dollar falls, that causes global purchasing power to rise and increases the demand for commodities. Meanwhile, you know, the supply side has been constrained. I mean, there's been underinvestment. So I do think that the weakness that you're seeing in a lot of commodities is temporary. And I do expect when we get a bigger drop in the dollar, remember, even though the dollar has been weakening and it's at a 7-month low today, it's still very close to a 14, 15 year high. So, you know, the dollar index just cracked below 96 today. So we're trading, you know, we've got just below 95. But remember, in 2008, the dollar index bottomed out at about 70. So, you know, we still have a very big dollar rally to reverse.
You know, a favorite indicator, new home sales, remains relatively strong. Before 2008, 2009, the Great Recession, they refer to it now, we saw an awful lot of weakness in new home sales. I know you watch homes closely. You actually correctly anticipated the last big break in U.S. housing prices and profited. Do you see any weakness ahead there for us? And is that really the backbone holding up the U.S. economy?
You know, we got the numbers today on pending home sales, and they were down for the third consecutive month. And, you know, the media likes to blame it on a shortage of homes, but I think it's a shortage of people that can afford to buy homes. You know, the real estate market has been propped up by the Fed, has been propped up by artificially low interest rates, and by the speculative buyers who have used those low interest rates in order to lever up and purchase real estate. But, you know, home ownership is near a 60-year low. So, if home ownership is so low, you know, what's propping up the real estate prices? And it's speculators, investors who have bought up homes and are renting them out, or they're just sitting vacant. But ultimately, I think there's still a lot of risk in U.S. residential real estate. In fact, U.S. commercial real estate is maybe even more vulnerable, given the closure of stores. I mean, this is probably the worst year, or will be the worst year in history by the time it's over, for store closings and bankruptcies in the United States. And this is not the end. I mean, this is going to continue for years to come. And of course, when stores go out of business, they don't pay their rent. And when you have a lot of commercial real estate with vacant space because there are no tenants, the value of those buildings falls. And as interest rates are rising, well, that's a double whammy. So, you know, we have a lot of problems in the real estate market.
Exactly. And we have a lot of problems as well in the retail space. And some pundits, the retail apocalypse, a really weakened middle class that is struggling in the last, let's say, decade. What do you see happening here, and what does it portend for the rest of us financially?
Well, I mean, the fact that people can buy things less expensively online is a positive, especially for people who are struggling to buy the things that they're buying. And so they're trying to save money every way they can. And so they're able to do that by shopping online. I mean, one reason is a lot of times when you buy something online, there's no sales tax. So right off the bat, you've got that. And then I guess the cost structures are much lower. They don't have the labor costs. You know, with rising minimum wages, a lot of these retailers are having a hard time having to pay higher wages to workers that, you know, companies like Amazon don't deal with. They just have robots that that work in warehouses. And so this, you know, is helping people survive a falling standard of living. And of course, you know, companies like Amazon aren't even making a profit, really. They're just selling at what it costs. So it makes it easier for them to deliver low prices because Amazon shareholders still don't care about profits. They just want to continue to grow and grow their market share, which is what has been happening. But you know, to me, it just really is a reflection of how bad things are. I think a lot of people, too, might prefer to buy things, you know, in a store. You know, it's cheaper to buy it online, and so that's what they do.
Okay, we talked about the retail apocalypse. Let's talk about what some folks are referring to as the robot apocalypse. The idea is, look, we just hear this week that McDonald's is replacing potentially thousands of employees with kiosks. I know the economist on one side will say, hey, you know, this is great. This is saving productivity. It's efficient. It lowers prices. The consumer benefits. And then the economy grows. Okay, but what about jobs? Return to Amazon. They now have fully automated stores for the most part. Do you see a trend here? And what does it mean, let's say, 5-10 years down the road?
Yeah, well, look, this has been going on since the beginning of time. I mean, obviously, when somebody invented the wheel, it put somebody out of work because, it was, you know, once you had a wheel and you can roll things, you didn't need as many people to push, right? So anytime we come up with a tool, that's why they call it a labor-saving device, because it saves labor, which is a scarce resource. I mean, we don't have an unlimited supply of labor. So to the extent that we have tools that can do jobs that can free up labor, then our standard of living is going to rise. And that is still the case today with automation and robots. Look, you know, I mean, this has been going on for a long time. I mean, how many people pump their own gas? At one point, nobody pumped gas because there was an attendant there that did it for you. Now we do it ourselves. You know, look at all these ATM machines. I mean, people, you know, you get money out of a bank, you don't have to talk to a teller. So this has been going on, but one of the things that is driving it faster is government, right? Because government runs up the cost of labor and makes it more advantageous for businesses to substitute capital for labor. Now, if absent government, capital is cheaper than labor, then it's always a good thing. But when you have governments artificially increasing the cost of labor so that you artificially increase the benefits of not using labor, then it's not a good thing. And so let's say that if, you know, there was no minimum wage, maybe McDonald's would not be replacing people with kiosks. Maybe, you know, if it could employ people at, you know, a market price, maybe that's still more efficient than the kiosks. But when they start saying you got to pay your unskilled workers $15 an hour plus benefits, right, plus run all the risks of being sued for, you know, violating all these various rules that you could, you know, violate as an employer. Being an employer is very risky. You know, you increase the benefit, right? When a company is deciding if it should replace workers with a machine, it does a cost-benefit analysis. And the cost is, well, what's the price of that machine? How much money do I have to spend to automate? And then what are the costs of maintaining the machine? The benefit is all the wages I don't have to pay. And so the more expensive government makes labor, the bigger the benefit to companies for eliminating labor. And so the government is accelerating all this automation as a response to higher minimum wage laws or employment taxes or mandated health benefits, all these things, you know, make it cheaper to use machines. But to the extent that companies make this decision, given these government, you know, impediments, it's still economically better for the country. But it would be even better for the country if the government didn't force the underutilization of labor, because obviously we have millions and millions of able-bodied people that could be employed, you know, but are not being employed because government laws make employing them illegal.
And there's so much emotion surrounding this, you know, almost threatening us, I think, civil war in this country, because we have the left and the right at war because they don't understand this dichotomy between socialism and capitalism that you've laid out here. Even though you've taken the capitalist side, do you worry that maybe there's an awful lot of leverage behind the capital that really sort of chokes out the middle class and the working class?
Middle class benefits most, and the poor, from automation and labor-saving devices, because the goal there is to reduce costs. And the people who benefit the most from a lower cost of living are the middle class. I mean, you take a very, very rich person. Take a Bill Gates, right? I mean, does Bill Gates even care, you know, what his groceries cost? Does he care what clothes cost? No. I mean, he could buy whatever he wants. He doesn't even have to look at the price. You could triple the price and it wouldn't affect him, right? But the average middle class person, their living standard is constrained by the cost. I mean, people are constantly shopping around, I mean, looking for the best deal, using coupons, right? People try to, lower their costs because they don't have an unlimited amount of money. So to the extent that a business can drive down the price of goods, it's the middle class and the poor that are the principal beneficiaries of those lower costs, not the rich. We used to have, you know, a workforce that was the highest paid in the world. I mean, our workers were, in better position than German workers. But we lost that dominance because of government intrusion into the labor force, into the economy. I mean, what enables workers to earn more money is increased productivity. And productivity comes from capital investment, and we don't have that. And also, you know, a lot of it is training. I mean, they still have a very good apprenticeship system in Germany. I mean, they don't have this fascination with education that every kid needs to go to college. In Germany, I mean, if you don't show a proficiency for academia early on, you just get routed, you know, into a trade. And I mean, and so that makes a lot more sense. I mean, we keep our kids in high school and college that can't even read. And then, you know, by the time they're in their 20s, they have no skills whatsoever. But, you know, the best apprenticeship type system is one that develops in the free market, not through government. But of course, we've made that illegal with the minimum wage laws and the way that, you know, we punish employers for trying to train workers. You know, you should be able to hire young people for practically nothing or nothing, and they should work for you for free while you're teaching them a valuable trade. But we've made that illegal, and so, you know, you don't have that kind of apprenticeship. You know, my grandfather became a carpenter, and he came here from Europe as a young boy. But before he came here, he worked for free. In fact, his parents basically almost had to pay so that he could work full-time for a carpenter in Europe. But while he worked unpaid, he learned the skills of carpentry. He didn't have to go and take out a loan to go to carpentry school. He worked for free while he was learning how to be a carpenter. And that set him up for his entire life. And he was able to support a wife and 8 children and have a home and have a car and, you know, have an entire life in America because he learned how to do something from a carpenter who wasn't required to pay him a wage. And if he was required to pay him a wage, he never would have got that opportunity. So we need to go back to that. People need to learn, not in school, but from people who actually know what they're doing, people who are, who are operating in the real world and can impart valuable skills to people. I mean, a lot of crafts and skills are lost on Americans. I mean, if you look at a lot of the jobs that require skills, they're being performed by immigrants because we don't train people in America. So if we want trained craftsmen, they're all here from other countries where they were able to learn a craft.
If I take your model a little further, I mean, what academia could do today, embrace an apprenticeship model where, look, you will receive credit when you go out and satisfy some work routine, maybe in various different areas where you show an aptitude, and then that might improve the odds of a career afterwards. You know, our high school system could have something along this line. It should be integrated. You feel as though that it's a bit wasteful because one can learn this on their own, especially with the internet today. And I think that's a pretty valid point.
For most people, higher education is a complete waste of money.
You know, I mean, it's and that's thanks to government, all the government subsidies that have driven up the cost of the degrees, and the fact that so many people have them basically destroys their value. I mean, there's nothing unique if you have a college degree because everybody else has the same degree. And the bottom line is you can get one of those degrees without learning anything, without improving your skills whatsoever. So how are you any more valuable to an employer?
So I think you would agree, at least if you're in a more sophisticated track, you want to become an actuary, a statistician, a lawyer, a veterinarian.
Yeah, there are some people that have more rigorous majors and that take their college experience seriously, but they're in the minority. You know, and those are the ones that should be there. But there are so many people that are there that shouldn't be there at all, but are there anyway because, you know, they've been indoctrinated into this and they've been funneled into this based on the idea that, well, if you don't go to college, you'll never amount to anything. And so everybody goes, and then you have to go, you know, you have to differentiate yourself by going for an advanced degree. So the college degree doesn't mean anything anymore. You need a master's degree, right? I mean, so serving the educational establishment that makes money off of this. But yeah, you mentioned, you know, the internet makes it easier for people to become self-educated. You know, a lot of America's, you know, greatest minds, you know, think of the founding fathers. Most of these guys didn't go to college. They were self-educated. But one of the reasons that people did go to college is because colleges had big libraries, right? You could get access to the books that you needed by being enrolled in a university. And of course, you had the professors, they would lecture, and you know, the only way you can hear the lectures were to be, have a seat in that classroom. But today, you know, you don't need a library to get books. You get all the books you want on your cell phone. And, you know, I can listen to lectures on the internet. I mean, I can go through, you know, YouTube or all sorts of podcasts. I can get the best minds teaching me whatever I need to know. I don't have to go near a classroom.
Okay, and as we wrap up here today, just a quick discussion on Zero Hedge. They noted this sort of flash crash, which I don't really think it was, on Monday you referred to. They saw 18,000 contracts over $2 billion dumped on the market in 1 minute. The volume was over 150% over the average in the London Stock Exchange. Do you see the powers that be behind the scenes here, or was this just a big hedge fund dumping?
I don't know who's behind it, but, you know, you notice this all the time in the gold market, you know, and generally it's in the morning, but all of a sudden there'll be a large sell order that'll come in and just hit the market. And it's, you know, it's very puzzling because normally, let's assume that you're trying to sell gold. The idea would be to get the best possible price for the gold that you're selling. You wouldn't want to just dump it all on the market and knock the price down $15 or $20. Why wouldn't you just slowly sell over the course of the day and not lose that $20, right? But for some reason, you always get these big sellers that seem to be more interested in knocking the price of gold down than getting a good, you know, price on the gold that they're selling. And so you think, well, what is their motivation for doing this? And I don't know. I mean, there could be some way they profit, maybe on options trades that have been done, or maybe in the gold stock market, maybe, okay, we'll lose an extra 10 or 20 bucks dumping all this gold, but maybe they make it someplace else. But I don't know if it's just all about just trying to keep the lid on the price of gold. Hey, every time it looks like it's about to break out, let's just dump it so we can do some technical damage so we can stop it from happening. But, you know, eventually, that's not going to work. I mean, the fundamentals can't be stopped. And if there is somebody or some collection of somebodies that are just trying to prevent the gold price from going up by dumping gold into the market, there is not an unlimited amount of it. They're going to run out. And of course, if they're just selling futures contracts and selling futures contracts, at some point, somebody is going to want to take delivery of those contracts more. You know, somebody, they can't keep the price down indefinitely.
Exactly. I mean, I think it really amounts to a giant naked short position. Just as we saw with many of the dot bombs, they were just shorted to oblivion. The only other thing I'd add in here is that I think we may be seeing the canary in the coal mine with the crypto domain. Because, look, you've got a market that simply cannot be naked shorted yet. They haven't figured out a way yet to cap these markets for good, meaning long term.
And yeah, and this is why, too, people need to get some physical gold. Don't think that, oh, I'm long a gold futures contract, so I own gold. The guy that's on the other side of that gold contract doesn't have any gold to deliver. And, you know, this thing can hold could blow up. You need to own real gold. You need to get it in your hands. You know, buy it for me at Shift Gold. You know, have, you know, get some real physical gold bars, gold coins in your possession. And I mentioned this before, everybody that listens to your show should own some of their gold through Gold Money. You know, go to goldmoney.com and set yourself up an account. Buy some gold online. The cheapest way I know to buy it, it's 0.5% over spot. Right, so buy yourself some gold. You can have delivery whenever you want, but the key is not to take delivery. Keep the gold in your account. It's in your name. You own it, but you can also spend it, right? You can spend it, you know, you can give it to people. You can use it to buy goods and services. You can spend it through an app on your cell phone. You can access it through a debit card, and you can spend your gold the same way you would spend your dollars using your bank ATM card. It lets you bank your gold. It lets you check out of the government banking system where the banks could fail or you can get bailed in, and check into your own vault by Brinks, where they're holding your gold for you, where you have instantaneous access to it 24/7. It's a digital wallet full of gold, right? And I know you got a lot of people now that are getting into these cryptocurrencies. These are just self-perpetuating Ponzi schemes. People are going to lose a lot of money in crypto fiat currencies the same way they're going to lose it in paper fiat currencies. People need to own real money, and Gold Money is a great way to do it. You know, goldmoney.com, and, you know, more importantly too, not only can you become an account holder and keep gold at Gold Money, but to the extent that you can tell your friends about it and get them to sign up, they have a referral program where every time your friend buys some gold, you can get a little commission on it. And every time your friend uses a debit card, spends some gold, trades his gold for silver or something like that, whenever there's a fee that's generated, if you introduce the account, you could earn a little revenue stream as a result of having helped establish that account.
Give us an idea as we wrap up here today, just how you could see this unfold with the precious metals. I mean, obviously, we don't have a crystal ball, but there are some signs out there, and you've written about it in your newsletters. Is that a major threat to dollar hegemony?
Oh, yeah. Look, dollar hegemony is going to go eventually. I mean, and it's going to happen quicker once it happens. And, you know, I don't know what the catalyst is going to be that's going to cause gold to take off. I mean, it may, in fact, have no catalyst at all. I mean, gold may move up hundreds of dollars an ounce or maybe more one morning or overnight for no apparent reason. You know, it's because it should already be much higher. So I don't know what the event is going to be to trigger it, and there may not be any particular event. It may all of a sudden just happen because it's inevitable that it's going to happen. But clearly, you know, as more people start to appreciate the predicament that the U.S. is in, you know, that the Fed is basically, you know, been lying or just been ignorant. I mean, Janet Yellen was out this week saying that we're never going to have another financial crisis in our lifetimes. She's confident of that. Meanwhile, they were just as confident that we weren't going to have the last financial crisis. But, you know, that one was caused by the Fed, and they were oblivious to it right up until it was over. They're just as oblivious to the one that's looming in our future. I mean, it's not like we're never going to have it again, and it's actually going to happen sooner rather than later. So as people figure this out, you know, you're going to have an abrupt change. You know, when the Fed, I think, when they have to acknowledge the weakness of the economy, when they have to stop hiking rates and start cutting them again, when they have to do QE4, you know, if the dollar, if, you know, we could even make it until then, I mean, look out.
It reminds one of Fisher's comments just before the peak in 1929 stock market. We've reached a permanent plateau of stock prices. So, I mean, this is history rhyming, repeating over again. Peter Schiff, any other contact information, or maybe you'd like to plug some of your other services?
Yeah, well, remember, anybody that wants to get involved, I mentioned, you know, the foreign stock markets are just on fire, the emerging markets in particular. You know, we manage a lot of accounts here at Europe Pacific Capital. I've got my family of mutual funds. So if you want to get money out of the U.S. and out of the U.S. dollar and invest it abroad in the countries that I like, places like Singapore and New Zealand and Switzerland and Hong Kong, give us a call. You know, at Europe Pacific Capital, it's europac.com is my website, europac.com. And, you know, you can call us at 800-727-7922 to talk to one of my representatives, get a broker. And also, you know, make sure and follow me online. I mean, go to my my podcast, Schiff Radio. They're also on my YouTube channel. Just search Peter Schiff. It's the Schiff Report on YouTube. You know, friend me on Facebook or Twitter, follow me. Just make sure and listen. It's not just, you know, the Gold Seek radios I do once in a while, but I put out my own content every week. There's new stuff coming out, so you don't have to wait for these appearances, you know, these times. I mean, listen to everything that I'm doing.
I'd also add the Europac Gold Fund is just one of the few out there that's really worth paying attention to. And I think you have maybe like a Class A, Class B.
You can buy the fund at Euro Pacific Capital, but there you can get them at Schwab and Fidelity if they're in the account. It's the Euro Pacific Capital. Our symbol is EPGFX, so if you don't want to confuse it, if you're trying to find it. The manager on the fund is Adrian Day. It's managed. ETFs are pretty much passive, where you just have a basket of stocks and it never changes. But we adjust the basket. We try to pick the best stocks. And, you know, when it comes to gold stocks, you know, not a lot of these gold stocks are, you know, are frauds. I mean, there's a lot of them that are landmines, not gold mines. So you really have to know your stuff, especially when you venture into the junior miners. I mean, that is, you know, where you have to know what you're doing. I mean, anybody can buy a senior mining company, right? I mean, they're, you know, but to try to find the potential in the exploration companies, there you really need to be an expert and know what you're doing.
Very good. All right, Peter Schiff, we'll have all your links up and look forward to hearing more from Peter Schiff.
Great. All right.
Featured guest today says the European Central Bank is at risk of failing, which could send interest rates soaring, outlines contingency plans for investors to shield their portfolios. Martin Armstrong, author of The Greatest Bull Market in History, Economic Confidence Model, and founder of Princeton Economics. Welcome back, Martin Armstrong.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Why don't you give listeners today an idea of what they should expect, the World Economic Conference that you'll be holding?
Well, that one in Frankfurt is mainly just focusing for the our European clients, and our main one for the World Economic Conference will actually be in Orlando. That comes in November in the States. The Frankfurt one is more of a seminar directed more at really the crisis that's developing in Europe, and that is the people don't realize. I mean, they keep hounding about the United States and oh, we have this debt and all this other kind of stuff. But the U.S. national debt, you know, at $18 trillion isn't really that much out of $150-plus, you know, trillion worldwide. And what they have to understand is that the biggest problem with the dollar and other currencies is if you go back to the Plaza Accord 1985 when they started G5, you know, that's where the U.S. told Europe, look, you need to create a single currency. We need something to compete against the dollar. They created the euro, but they never basically consolidated all the debts, and so they left everything still independent, and that's a problem because big institutional money still then has to look at Europe the same way they would look at the states in the U.S. You know, is it, you know, they'd look at the credit ratings of California versus New York or Illinois, etc. So it's not just a single credit rating. So you have, you know, like the 10-year bonds going up and against the Italians and the Spanish, etc. So they never really created a single market as beyond just the image of the currency. And then you have the central bank and, you know, what has happened with this quantitative easing. Europe just went completely nuts. Draghi has been, you're putting people in these positions who have no experience whatsoever. You might as well put a cab driver involved. I mean, he goes in, okay, fine, we're going to increase money, put it into the system, but then they raise taxes. So, you know, this idea of quantitative easing, if I give you $100 and I say you give me 90 back, what did I give you, 100 or 10? You know, they don't look at it from a whole perspective. You put in all this money, I mean, even the U.S., you know, all this hype about, oh, we're going to see hyperinflation, etc. That assumes that the money is actually going into the economy and it's going to stimulate and be spent by who? The consumer. All right? When you're giving it just to the bankers, you're assuming, you're hoping and praying the bankers might lend the money out, but they never did. All right? So then the bankers go back to the Fed and say, gee, you're buying up all the bonds. We don't have a place to put money. Oh, okay, fine. So then the Fed creates excess reserves. And then they put about $3 trillion in there. Okay, so how did the money actually stimulate anything? You bought the bonds, you gave the bankers the cash for the bonds, then they gave you the cash back and put it at the Fed, and the Fed then pays them 0.5% interest. They never lent the money out. So you have to pick up the rug when you're looking at this stuff. And, I mean, all the bashing of the Fed, etc., that is nothing in comparison to what's happened in Europe. In Europe, you know, the ECB bought in government bonds, but they've been doing this for nearly 10 years with no effect whatsoever. So what's, at this point in time, what's going on? The ECB owns 40% of all the national debts of all the EU countries, Eurozone countries. 40%. Now, what's going to happen when they stop? Who's going to buy it? There's no bid. All right, so interest rates are going to have to rise substantially before somebody's going to be willing to buy this stuff.
But we have a system that's been teetering since, you know, 2008, 2009, the Great Recession. The only thing holding the whole edifice up is negative interest rates. I mean, real interest rates. I mean, look at the PBOC, negative 3.75% for the overnight lending rate. EU, as you've already pointed to, first time in history, negative interest rates for their major banks. I mean, what happens if rates go up? Doesn't the whole Titanic flip?
Yeah, I mean, it has actually happened when you consider Europe. All right, with the ECB buying 40% of the debt. Now, first of all, what they're proposing, and it's part of why the euro has been rallying, and they've, you know, people don't understand what is actually at stake here. The proposal is that, oh, well, our problem is we don't have a euro bond, which is correct. All right, but Germany is against issuing a euro bond. So what they're doing is they're creating a derivative, which is exactly the same thing they did in 2007. Instead of putting mortgages in these things, they're putting the government bonds into them. So it's a mixture of bonds of Europe. And so they're attempting to bail out the ECB. Because as soon as rates go up, what's going to happen to the ECB's portfolio? Those bonds are going to crash. I mean, you're talking about really the Titanic here. And it's the only central bank that can actually fail. The Fed is like, you know, walking on water here. There's no way impossible. The Fed is in much better shape than any central bank in the world.
So really what you're saying is the EU, the ECB, really just a failed business model, economic model from the onset, was doomed because really you have a loose collaboration. There really isn't any unification between the peripheral states, the countries, if you will. And unlike the United States, which are united under one federal system, there really isn't a federal legal system in place. Will we see higher rates in the domestic United States following this implosion in the EU?
The Fed is also trapped. What you have to understand is that, you know, people, you know, you get a lot of people hating the dollar, et cetera. I probably get called into more governments than anybody else been around. But when I go to Washington, there are people beginning to realize that the U.S. as a reserve currency is a problem. And the problem is that you lose domestic policy objectives to international. So the Fed wanted to raise interest rates, and then you have emerging markets in Europe lobbying them. Say, oh, please don't do that because you're going to hurt us. So who is the Fed supposed to, you know, to deal with? Domestic economy or the international economy? This is the problem. The Fed has become the international central bank. Not intentionally, it's just the way it's happened. So the Fed should have been raising rates a lot sooner. All right, they waited to 2015, and then they said, look, we have to do this. The stock market's going up. I mean, if the stock market's going up, you're going to have effectively all the, you know, the Democrats yelling at them, oh, see, you're helping the rich with these low interest rates. We look at everything like a horse with blinders on, as if it's just the United States. So the Fed has no choice but to raise interest rates, otherwise it will be criticized by the Democrats for helping the rich. Then raising the interest rates when everybody else is negative, then that causes capital to come into the United States and sends the dollar up even higher and the stock market up even higher. So they're trapped. The same exact thing took place in 1927. The U.S. lowered interest rates. The central bank lowered the interest rates to try and help Europe. And they thought it would send the capital flows back to Europe. And it didn't. When they did that, people realized, wait a minute, the central bank is actually trying to do this. That means the trouble over here in Europe is much worse than we suspected. The capital moved this way. That's why, if you just look at the charts, the interest rates doubled. The Fed doubled the interest rates between 1927 and 1929, and the stock market doubled. This is the same thing happening again. And it's, you know, people, you know, don't understand about stock markets. They say, oh, it's going to crash and all this other kind of stuff. Again, they're only looking at this stuff with, you know, domestic, you know, blinders on. You know, if you look at the P.E. ratio, all right, they say, oh, the market's overvalued. Well, first of all, the P.E. ratio hit 50 at the top in the dot-com bubble. But where is the historical high? It's actually 2009. Reached almost 200. Why? And just ask yourself this question. If you think the banks you don't trust, you don't trust government, what are you going to do? Where do you put your money? They were buying blue chips. At least, okay, I know, I want to put my money someplace where I break even or close to it. It's not a question of, oh, gee, I'm going to earn 4% here versus 5%. You do reach a point where you just want your money back. It's called parking. Put that out. I mean, Barron's did an article, which I thought was funny. Back in 2011, we came out, we said, look, the U.S. is going to make new highs. And they did an article, didn't interview me. They wrote, oh, gee, Armstrong's calling for new highs. Like, ha, ha, ha. Like, that's really going to happen. That was in 2011, all right? You get up to this point, I mean, I had someone else ask me for an interview, and I said, well, you know, what do you want to interview me about? And he said, you're the only guy that's been bullish. Everybody that comes on this show is negative. That's why the stock market keeps going up.
What will be the trigger point? I mean, obviously, there will be Time Magazine or Business Week will show, you know, Dow to infinity. You know, your Uber driver, not cabbie now, your Uber driver will have just made $1 million on Netflix or Google options. Okay, we know those signs. What will Martin Armstrong be watching for a top here, an ultimate, you know, zenith in U.S. equities?
It's basically capital flows. Back in 2011, we gave three targets on the Dow. Our first target was 18.5. We reached that. Okay. Our next one was 23,000, which we've been approaching. And then if we get through 23, we've been warning that then you get into what we call a phase transition. And a phase transition, to put it like in gold terms, 1976 gold fell to $100. By December 1979, it finally got to 400. All right? It went from 400 to 875 by January 21st. So you're looking at the last 6 weeks, all right, is what we call a phase transition. All right? a doubling effect in a very short period of time. That's what we're looking for in the Dow. When you see that, you know, it will probably get through 23,000, and then you're going to be looking at the high 30s to like 40 to 42. When you see all these bears that are out there, which I think is more than 90%, when they finally flip, I mean, imagine, you know, I wrote, this is the most hated bull market in history. The whole bull market from the and during the 1920s, all right, was 97 months. So at month 97, shoeshine boys are buying it. This is it. We've reached a permanent plateau. We reached 97 months this past April. Where are they? They're still bearish.
I still get emails regularly here from subscribers, listeners who say, you know, I was so burned by 2008, 2009 stock market crash. I can never even look at a market ticker again. What about the fact the middle class has been decimated? We've lost close to 5 million official high-paying manufacturing jobs outsourced. The middle class is wiped out. And, of course, the upper elite are happy days here again, blue skies. How important is that? Because right now the Fed just released a report showing 44% of Americans have not a single dollar in savings for an emergency. I think it was 75% have less than $500 to $1,000 in savings. If the middle class is not participating in the market rally, how might that change the character of this rally and the ultimate crash that follows?
Well, what you're looking at is capital inflows. And that's really what's behind a lot of it. We're not looking at, you know, the average person running out and you know, buying equities per se. But you're looking at more of a situation where, you know, we're the prettiest of the three ugly sisters, you know, as they say, from Asia and Europe. And Europe, I mean, if we're looking at a very serious situation developing in Europe, the smart money has no place to go but here. And you just look at it this way. The U.S. was bankrupt in 1896. All right, that's when J.P. Morgan had to lend $100 million in gold to the U.S. Treasury to bail it out, etc. We go from 1896 to 1945. After two world wars, the U.S. ends up with 76% of the world's gold reserves. Why? Because Europe is blowing itself up. Smart money moves. All right? It all came to the United States. If that hadn't happened, we'd still be mostly farmers. Farming was 40% of society in 1900. It was 70% in 1850. So, the jobs, what we're, you know, people have to realize and that, you know, we're also going through this age of really technology advancements. I mean, the Great Depression, what made it great was actually innovation. When the combustion engine, once that came into play, you had development, it moved into tractors by 1920, etc. So that displaced a lot of jobs. That's why unemployment went to 25%, because agriculture was 40% of the civil workforce. So the combustion engine wiped out most of these farmers. They're the ones that became the hobos. So, you know, World War II came into play, and these people then were, you know, put into war, et cetera, to give them employment. They didn't have the skill set. And this is the same problem we have going on right now. And as technology advances, we don't necessarily need the manufacturing so much or service jobs. Service jobs are getting really hammered. And, you know, they don't understand, you know, these politicians we put into play, oh, it sounds nice, oh, we should double the minimum wage, these poor people don't have anything to live on. No, that's not the answer. The answer is basically to teach them a skill. And because what happens is you raise the minimum wage, and when what happens? You then have Obamacare putting all kinds of burdens of regulatory and benefits, etc. So you get, you know, stores, Wawa's and 7-Elevens and McDonald's, whatever. They can replace these people very easily with a little screen. You go in, you pick what you want, that's it, comes out the back.
The CEO of Carl's Jr. just called for all his stores in the next few years to go fully automated. You swipe your card.
You go to the Frankfurt Airport in Germany. It's the most advanced I've seen anywhere. There's nobody there behind the counter. You go to check in, you put your passport in the machine, out comes your boarding pass. You then take your bag over, you put it on a scale, all right, it then weighs it, it puts out the, you know, the tag, you put it on the thing, and off it goes.
The Ethereum model so impressed IBM and a few other major companies. This is, of course, the cryptocurrency Ethereum. What they did is take Ethereum and take a washing machine. The washing machine used Ethereum to call the repair person when the machine broke down and pay the repair person and then order new parts.
Just go to Starbucks and stand in line and you'll see everybody that's probably under 30, maybe even, you know, mid-20s, whatever, they just hold up their phone and pay. All right? People talk about gold is money. Okay, to these people, not even paper is money. I mean, things are changing. And so it's substantially different. It's not universal income. It's more or less that you have to... really, if you, you know, the old saying, you know, if you give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. If you teach him how to fish, you feed him for a life. That's really what has to happen. But it is often the older generation, which are the people from the manufacturing, et cetera, that do not adapt and do not move forward and retrain themselves. And so they become antiquated within the system. And that's the problem. And so this occurs all the time. And there are waves of innovation. And when the railroad happened, Sears, you know, which is going down now, but Sears was one of the first mail order companies. You'll see old Western movies where, you know, people went to the general store and they ordered something and then it came by train. Train was basically the internet back then. It was the Amazon. You could order it and it would be delivered. All right. So, it wasn't as efficient as Amazon is today, but the same principle. So it's innovation takes place always with technology. The technology may slightly change, but the basic principle is always the same. So you had the trains create the wave of innovation in the 19th century. Then you had the combustion engine. Then you had airplanes. And basically, then you had computers. And, you know, the dot-com bubble was a big thing. But, you know, people see the future, but then they run away with it too fast. So then the dot-com, you know, crashes and burns. But, I mean, our own company, I mean, I get so often, because we tend to be opposite. We're the biggest institutional advisor in the world. Why? Because we used to deliver our reports by Western Union in the late 70s. And if we would cover a market and we would send out three reports on that market per day as it was trading, and it was $50 a piece if you were, like, overseas to get, you know, so you're talking about $150 per day to get three telexes. Then effectively most of our clients could only be institutions because the communication costs were like $200,000 to $250,000 a year. And a retail person couldn't possibly afford that. That's where we started opening up offices overseas so we could, you know, deliver one telex to there, and then that would redistribute, bring the cost down for people. Then faxes came. Okay, now we go from $50 to $3. All right, now the internet's here, okay, and we have over 600,000 people at this stage in the game. So it gets to be, you know, it's interesting, but technology has changed our firm. And we can, you know, we have our own computer system that we've been a forerunner in developing for years. I mean, so we have, we use artificial intelligence. We basically created, I mean, I began in programming myself, so I had programming skills and trading skills. So I basically wrote a program years ago that taught the computer how to do this. And so now we have a system, Socrates, and I mean, you can go to our website and see it. It's armstrongeconomics.com. But I mean, the computer actually writes all the forecasting reports. And it's covering every market in the world. And the one thing that is great about it, one, we're one of the few companies that's not blocked in China. Why? Because the government knows what we're doing. They know in paragraph 3, we're not slipping in a little line, oh, by the way, overthrow your government. They know it's all written by a computer. So we're one of the few people that are basically not blocked in China. And governments rely upon us all the time because it's not biased. It's a computer that's doing it, and it's very black and white. That's it. Simple as that. And we all have opinions, but you can't forecast markets from opinions. I mean, maybe you'll be right one time. Maybe you will be wrong the next time. I mean, this computer basically was the only thing that legitimately forecast that Trump would win, Brit exit, that Spain, you know, that Catalonia would vote to separate. I mean, it's done every election. It came out and even said that Le Pen would beat all the mainstream parties in France. So you can't do this from an opinion perspective. The computer's looking at absolutely everything. You can go on our site and look. We've posted charts. And when you look at it, at the politics from a market perspective, all right, how many seats? We have a chart we put on there. How many seats do Democrats and Republicans hold combined between the Senate and Congress, all right? The Democrats peaked with the first election of FDR. Ever since, they've been making lower highs and lower lows. It's been a bear market all along. All right, people just don't quite get that, you know, they get caught up in the fundamental nonsense. And the basic trend has been down. Why? Because we put it very bluntly. This is the collapse of socialism. This is the West's turn, all right? China and Russia went through the collapse of communism. This is still the same problem. Socialism and communism, what do they have in common? Centralized government planning. All right? Communism, they own your house. Under socialism, you own your house, but the government taxes the hell out of you for it, and it tells you what you can do and cannot do. All right, so it's still centrally controlled. All right, and that doesn't work because a politician never understands anything. And I can tell you, I mean, I've been called into so many different governments around the world and Brady commissions and back for the 85, G5 formation and stuff. And I can give you one conclusion that I have discovered, I think. And that is, you can walk into Congress and say, if you do not do this, 20 million people will die tomorrow. And you know what they'll say? Maybe you'll be wrong. All right. think of it this way. If I were to run for president and I say, vote for me because I saved your job, the first thing you're going to ask is that, how did I know I was going to lose it? All right? You just, you know, BSing me or, you know, what's going on? It's much better for a crisis to happen. You lose your job. Then I run and I say, vote for me. I'll get the guy that did it. Government never prevents anything. All right? I've been called into everything from the Reagan administration on down, and I've learned it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Republicans, Democrats, all the same thing. Just show me the money. That's what it comes down to. I was called in to help, you know, supposedly privatize Social Security back when the Dow was 1,000. I show them how to do this, set this up, okay, fine. Democrats killed it. Why? Because they said, no, we want to be able to change the managers if we, when we get into power. And I said, this has got nothing to do with, you know, putting your brother-in-law in. You know, I don't care what's, if somebody has the best track record, that's where we go. All right? I don't ask them, who did you vote for? It's nonsense. I mean, Hong Kong, when Hong Kong was being turned over to China, all right, I had the mandate to try and buy property from Australia. I met with the Australian government. There was an island offshore of I said, look, I'll buy this island. Hong Kong wants to move down here. No, we can't give sovereignty. So then I said, okay, fine. Give us the upper left corner of Australia. They'll come down here. Okay, fine. You don't have to give us sovereignty, but it's its own state. And still denied. I met with the finance minister at the time was Paul Keating, who became prime minister. All right. And I said, what is it? I have a blank check to write here. I could pay off the national debt of your country. You know what he said to me? I thought it was racist. He says, no. He says, it's not racist. He says, they're not labor people. They were afraid that if all these people came in, that they would vote conservative and the labor government would be out of power. They only look at themselves. I could have paid off the national debt of Australia. I had to go back to Hong Kong and say, very sorry, I can't do it.
I'd like your thoughts, though, on precious metals. I mean, obviously, if you think U.S. equities are headed possibly much higher, do you see more trouble ahead for the precious metals, or will they catch some of the uptrend along with equities?
Eventually, the precious metals will turn up, and they will turn up with equities. Because at that point in time, what you're looking at, some individuals will look at buying the metals as a safe haven. The big money will be looking at buying equities. Talking about pension funds and stuff like that. They can't buy, you know, 1 ounce coins or bars or stuff like that. They need to earn income. They can buy gold stocks, but they can't buy bullion. So, they will eventually both move up together. But in order to do that, that's when we cross that threshold. And suddenly everybody wakes up and says, oh my God, what's going to happen here in Europe or Asia? And then you move all the capital into the U.S. You're looking at just parking. That's when gold will take off. It's not, you know, this hyperinflation, oh, they increased the money supply, this. Look, that, you know, you only get to a real bull market when people question who's going to survive. And that's what you have to look for. As far as money supply and increasing this and all that kind of nonsense, it doesn't mean anything because you're not looking at the real full picture. All right? I mean, Bitcoin took off like heck. Why? Because over 90% of them were in China. They were just using it to take money out of the country. And the Chinese were buying up all the property in the United States and Canada, etc., like the Japanese were back in the 90s. All right, it's you look at a lot of Chinese, and they didn't trust their government. I gotta get some money out before something happens. and that's what they were doing, using for Bitcoin.
Okay, last question. Is there a tropical port of call in Europe you'll be vacationing in after the big Frankfurt conference?
No, I have meetings. All right, well, take care. Thank you for inviting me.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. Educating yourself and asking your own questions. These are fundamental basic survival skills you must adopt if you are going to survive the maze of misinformation, slanted reporting, and outright avoidance of reporting on issues that should otherwise be discussed and spotlighted. The allure and hypnotic trance relied upon by mainstream media for so many decades to entrain and capture the consciousness of most people is fading fast. The trance has broken, and more people are waking up. A bureaucratically top-heavy mainstream media, paying exorbitant salaries not to journalists, but to actors, crisis actors, to peddle the scoop of the day. Truth is the casualty in favor of a thinly veiled political ideology that creeps into and drives much of today's reporting. And when the public wakes up and starts questioning their media masters, who have consolidated the mainstream media and transformed it into the modern equivalent of the dinosaur, unable to adapt to rapid change and risking extinction in its present form, when the public wakes up and starts asking real questions that that branch of the media doesn't want to discuss, the public goes elsewhere for its news. And the media goes crazy. They think we, the people, have been led astray by those decadent, alternative media voices. They believe, in response, that the more noise they make, the more justice we think we're getting. They think the more noise they make, the more our interests are supposedly being served. How wrong they are. How wrong they have been and continue to be. The media has contributed to creating and reinforcing an ever-increasing multi-class system that we all live under. There are the untouchables at the top, who can do just about anything, and those who would enforce or legislate against them are often afraid to because of repercussions. Then there's the professional class, not entirely untouchable, but pretty much. They can afford the best of everything, but occasionally some are thrown to the wolves as examples of justice to the average person, or as a message to others at their level. Then we have the middle class, a large but shrinking demographic, as more of them slip further down the economic ladder through the occasional financial crisis and unacknowledged inflation, which invisibly destroys their purchasing power year after year. Then we have the poor and dependent, who are a fast-growing demographic. There's plenty of justice for the poor, the middle class, and some of the professional class. But the untouchables, well, they just seem to remain untouchable. Until now. Hard questions are being asked by more and more independent journalists. Mainstream media, which is so large and bureaucratically top-heavy, has become the dinosaur, which can no longer adapt to its suddenly changing environment, and is in the death throes of survival from both a financial and credibility perspective. For those of us that have followed the gold market for so long, we know how mainstream financial media has ignored and continues to ignore the questions on surreptitious machinations of the gold market and the greater economy at large. When Bill Murphy of Gata first went on CNBC at the turn of the century in 2000 and discussed a non-transparent, manipulated gold market, he was never asked back again. It was the alternative media and its rise, especially in the financial sector, that spawned the creation of much of the new media we see today. And it was and remains the alternative media that has given voice to so many astute individuals that have helped educate a growing number of people to simply ask questions. One occurrence this week that was covered nowhere in mainstream media, but was covered by Zero Hedge and Chris Powell of Gata, is how the gold futures market, on a surge in volume with 18,000 contracts, which was just over $2 billion notional, how it all traded in a one-minute window. That sudden selling soaked up all the liquidity in the gold market within seconds, and clearly was designed to instantly and dramatically reprice gold at lower levels. Who has $2 billion of gold to sell to neatly tap the price down and then get on with their morning coffee? What purpose does an exercise like that serve? If you've been listening to this show for any period of time, you already know the answer. But almost no one, especially in the mainstream media or the mainstream financial media, will ever dare to ask such questions. Because every time one of these grossly exaggerated trades sneaks by, we inch one step closer to a gold market that will reset and reprice itself, and maybe in the fallout from that, the untouchables will finally become touchable. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.